Hey guys, this is Nikhil.
And this is Nick.
And welcome back to Informatonauts.
Episode number 12. Apologize that we're coming at you a little bit later than we normally do. So this week has gotten away from me a bit, so I apologize. But here we are now. So,
and we still haven't found that microphone, AWOL microphone.
We haven't. I was going to ask you why it sounded like we were broadcasting out of a toilet, but I guess that's the reason, so.
Well, it sounds more like aluminum foil to me.
Well, I think we need to wrangle our IT guys and string them up by their toes. We sent an email, and we were like, hey, does anyone know where the podcasting mic is? And our IT guy said, I haven't been down there in a week. It's like, well, that's probably part of the issue.
And the other ones didn't even reply to us. They were just like, oh, these guys.
Yeah.
Great.
So we're going to have to come up with a better solution for that, but anyways, better late than never, right? Mm-hmm.
What you drinking there? What you got?
Oh, well, so today on my way down to the office, I missed my bus, and so I did what I normally do on my consolation prize. I walked down to Neptune Coffee, and I grabbed myself a delicious pour-over. Today I'm doing a Burundi from Belton's that is absolutely phenomenal.
Cool. Very cool.
And you are sipping on nothing, I see.
Well, actually, I used my Chemex this morning, and I made myself a Kuma Kenya roast.
Ooh, how was that?
Oh, that was really good. Yeah. I like it. I like the Kenyan roast a lot better than anything else, I think.
The Kenyans are really good. I think I'm partial to Central America, but I will basically not turn down anything.
So. I think the African coffees are where it's at, man.
Yeah. I was out. I had a really great Ethiopian Adido from Velton's also that I was enjoying over the last week and just finished that off yesterday. So it was I wasn't planning on doing any coffee, but you know when you just that demoralizing feeling when the bus is like just pulling away as you're coming out of your house, you're just like, well, screw it. So I went down to Neptune, saw my friends, and came down here.
Cool, very cool.
Spilled most of it on myself on the way down. So,
oh, that sucks.
Yeah, it's interesting. The dynamics are really fascinating. Where when you're sitting there, and all of a sudden the bus will hit a bump, and you just see the liquid kind of like surge up and out through that top hole and then spill everywhere. And you're like, okay, it was not nearly that big of a bump, but somehow like there must be like a force multiplier in the cup or something that just like it just shoots out everywhere. Like, oh gosh.
You know what's interesting is yesterday I'm doing the whole restaurant week thing.
And oh yeah.
I ate at Shonik. It's like a trendy Indian restaurant. And right down the street over here.
Really?
Next to Amazon. Right. Wow. So what the interesting thing is they were giving us free cups of chai. But the cups that they gave us the chai in, it was kind of designed backwards. You know how a cup kind of starts like small at the bottom and gets bigger towards the top?
Yeah.
This was the opposite.
Yeah,
and it was just so stable. Like that was just some great design in that cup.
Yeah, that is brilliant. Why is it that cups get narrow and get bigger as they go up?
Maybe because you want to have like space for your mouth to, I don't know, like your nose or, I have no idea.
I think I heard once that there was like a reason. I've heard fitting in car, so like when you slide it into a cup holder, it will basically like seal itself in. The same reason why a tomahawk gets bigger as it goes up. So that way, you didn't know this?
No.
So when you throw a tomahawk, it's narrower at the bottom than it is at the top. So that way, when you throw it, the gravity will lock. When you throw the gravity, and the centripetal force will pull the head tight. So that way, it doesn't wobble.
Wow. Did not know that.
And that way, they're super simple to make. Like you can make them with the most basic tools. And then when you throw it, the centripetal force pulls the head and latches it tight against the top of the.
Very, very interesting.
Yeah, it is. It is kind of fascinating. But I have seen some designs of like those ramen bowls. Like the number. I was at a class once. They were talking about the number of like
Wanda's
burns.
Class.
Was that Wanda's class?
That was Wanda's
right.
Class.
In Wanda's design methods class, one of the best classes I've taken here. Mm-hmm. Absolutely phenomenal. It was narrower at the bottom, and then it got wider at the bottom and then narrower at the top, and it was kind of great. There you go. So you're looking at tomahawks.
I am. I kind of want one now.
They're so cool. They are kind of awesome. They're really fun to throw, and they're really easy to play with.
And how scary are they? I mean, imagine a guy walking down the street with a gun and a guy walking down the street with a tomahawk. Who would you be more afraid
of? I mean, the logical side of me goes obviously the guy with the gun, but the guy with the tomahawk just looks way more BA.
Right.
Like, you're just like, that guy is going to, he's going to tomahawk me.
Yeah. That's going to hurt a lot more than a bullet.
So, I guess it depends, but anyways.
It's about 30 bucks, man.
Yeah, they're kind of
affordable.
Awesome. Oh, look at that. Is that a tactical tomahawk?
Yeah.
because apparently you can't just have a normal tomahawk when going to war against the cowboys and them union forces. You got to have your tactical tomahawk.
This is crazy.
Now, speaking of, I see that you're over there on Amazon. Have you heard of Amazon Smile?
I have heard of Amazon Smile.
I just signed up for Amazon Smile the other week. They just announced a new partnership with the Boy Scouts of America, or at least it popped up in my news feed. Mm-hmm. It may have been there for a while. And as an Eagle Scout, that rings dear to my heart. So I signed up, and so now I'm supporting Smile, and I feel terrible for not doing it before. Earlier. Yeah. Now, what's annoying is that you only get notified up to like four times to go, because you have to go to smile.amazon.com, not just Amazon, and it won't redirect you. So you have to actually know to go to smile.amazon.com.
I wonder why, though. I wonder why they don't just default to Smile.
Or at least set an option for you to say, do you want to? But it says, it's like, we only remind you two more times to go to smile.amazon.com. So now I'm just trying to like force that muscle memory so that I always type smile.amazon. And right now I just type SM and it pops up in Chrome. So
maybe it's for tax reasons. I don't know.
I honestly don't know. I mean, I don't think they pay very many taxes anyways as it goes, but I don't know. I'm sure there's some reason or whatever, but yeah, if you're not signed up and using Smile, it's pretty phenomenal. They get like, I mean, you get a half of a percent of each transaction, but when you're talking about millions of transactions, it's potentially a really awesome program, and at no cost to you. They don't charge you anymore. It doesn't change. It's anything that you can buy that's eligible for Prime, basically. And the list is, they pull from like Charity Track or Charity Watch or something like that. They pull from one of those big like national databases, so it's guaranteed the 501c3. You can pick which one you want. I know that. Like with the Boy Scouts, you could support the National Council or your local districts and things. If they were – a bunch of those were up on there as well. You can do the Scout of Cancer Care Alliance, all sorts of different nonprofits, which is really, really cool. So, and if you're talking – you know, if you have a nonprofit that you like and you support – oh, one of their featured ones is Code.org, which is really awesome. Nonprofit as well. So Charity Water is another one that was popped up there. But you know, for smaller nonprofits, there's an ability for them to kind of come in at almost no cost, and it just kind of feeds right into their revenue stream. So,
well, cool. I'm glad they're doing that. That's awesome. So I see a link here that you've forwarded to me, entitled "The Smartest Company in the World."
That's right.
So I'm going to open that up here.
This is going to be fun. So who is the number one smartest company? And now let's clarify here. Smartest company in the world is not – it's not a traditional ranking like number of PhDs or number of patents issued. It's companies that MIT – it's from MIT Technology Review that they find to be the smartest in their business sense, their strategy, their position, like all that kind of stuff that makes them just the smartest. Because I think if you went by pure number of PhDs on staff, I think that number is Oracle. I think Oracle has the most – at least they did. They were bragging that they had more PhDs than NASA. But NASA currently had like the most. So it would be like Oracle or IBM or somebody like that. Hmm. And you'll notice I don't think either of them are on that list. But Nikhil, who is number one
on this list? I am proud to say that Illumina is number one. And if you guys don't remember, Illumina was the company that I used to work for before I came to UW. So I am honestly surprised to see that Illumina is ahead of the list. And, you know, and it's in front of Tesla. It's in front of Google. It's in front of Samsung, Amazon, BMW, Uber, Box, SpaceX. They've put Jay Flatley, the CEO of Illumina, in front of Elon Musk, the CEO of Tesla and SpaceX. And that to me is a shock.
It is a bit of a shock. I was totally surprised by that.
But I do see some truth in that. I mean, Jay definitely is a very smart guy. But man, I just would not have put them at number one. That's crazy. Like, I guess there's not too much hype around Illumina as opposed to hype around Tesla. If you just watch the news feeds, you see a new thing about Tesla almost every day. But Illumina kind of just stays stable, I'd say. Yeah. Relatively stable. It's popped up over the past few months.
I've been seeing them more and more often. So, I think it's – now, MIT Technology Review is – I really enjoy the stuff that they post. I think they have really interesting things. And I think they do a pretty good job of being intelligent and systematic about their approaches. They're a lot less they're a lot less susceptible to hype and that kind of stuff. But I was genuinely surprised about that as well. And so we'll because Walmart, I think Walmart is on that list, right?
It well, it's kind of a weird list. I do see it. I see Walmart stores at 16.
Yeah.
You know what is not on this? I see Snapchat, but what's not on this list is Apple. I see GitHub.
Are they number 5?
I don't see Apple here. I see Salesforce at number 5, but Apple is not on this list. So for some reason,
right.
The MIT Review does not think Apple is a smart company.
I think that, again, it's the metric by which they are judging that smartness, which is not just number of intelligent
and
people.
Snapchat. Wow, Snapchat's on there.
That one kind of blows me away. I'm not super thrilled about, but you know. But yeah, we all have our own little biases and stuff. So
actually, what ticks me off is seeing Oculus VR on this list.
Yes, so Oculus, they were making waves.
Definitely.
What was going on over there? Give us a quick recap for those people who don't follow gaming technology.
Also,
and I can't speak because I don't game.
So basically, Oculus VR was this project that was funded on Kickstarter, and they got about $2 million in funding from people, from just average Joes out there who wanted this technology to exist. And then once they actually got the money and they started to make this virtual reality system, Mark Zuckerberg bought it.
He did.
They sold out to Facebook. And then, as far as I understand, people on Kickstarter are not going to see that technology that they funded, nor will they see a dime from the guys who sold out to Facebook. And this really made me angry because just a few months before, you had this whole thing about Flappy Bird.
Yep.
And it was like this – I mean the Flappy Bird thing was like there's this guy in Vietnam – this like taxi cab driver who at night learned iOS programming, and then I just
hold on. He's not a taxi cab driver. He works for a taxi cab company. He writes software. He has a computer science degree.
Are you sure? Because I remember reading that in a publication somewhere that he's a taxi cab driver.
No, the one that I just read the Rolling Stone. Finally, read the Rolling Stone piece the other week.
Okay,
and so he is a programmer.
Ah,
and
okay.
That's what he does. And he writes, but his day job is like. He writes the GPS systems for the taxi company in Hanoi.
Well, either way, he made a game.
Yes, he did.
Just for fun. He didn't expect it to take off at all. He just kind of uploaded it and was like, hey, let's just see how this goes. It's a small experiment, right? And by some stroke of luck, it just took off. It was phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And it ended up going viral. And all of a sudden, he was like getting like
– vilified.
Yeah. Like lots of gaming blogs were just – ranting about him and how he stole stuff and how he's a thief, and like there was a lot of stress that poor guy went through, and he had to just pull the game off the market because he was just like, I don't want to deal with all the lawsuits, I don't want to deal with all this being turned into a villain.
He's getting death threats against him and his family and
yeah
stuff.
Like what's up with that? And like people, I mean, this guy was just making a game to like learn how to make a game. He wasn't trying to make money. The fact that he did was, I think, was like this awesome just this awesome thing that happened. He was just blessed. But these folks, the Oculus folks, who basically went out and said they're going to take $2 million of people's money and build this cool public thing and then just extol it literally and then sold out to Facebook and didn't give anybody else a dime, that's – nobody like said a bad thing about that at all. Everyone was just like, oh, well, that's cool, you know. So I don't know. That ticked me off a lot, and I don't know why the internet reacts – so harshly to a single individual, and then gives a company like Oculus a free pass.
I think part of it was, one, a lot more people had buy into Flappy Bird. A lot of people, I mean, and millions of people were the day when he had, I think I read that when he announced that he was going to pull it off the App Store in like 24 hours. I think 10 million people downloaded it or something. I mean, it was just an astronomical number.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot more people had buy-in than they did with Oculus. So I looked at the Oculus thing, and it doesn't hit home to me because I didn't support. I think it's an interesting and fascinating technology that I'm excited to keep developing, but it's not on my radar, really. And I probably won't purchase one, at least for a long time. So I think that there's that sense to it as well. But I do think that the people who were involved in and around this were quite angry and quite frustrated.
Well, I hope they are because, like, they got their money stolen from them.
They got – It's interesting. So one of the reasons why I think people are really angry about this is the same reason why people are angry about Crimea. Because Putin, Father Putin, that's his official title, Father Putin, realized that there's a gap in international law that allows you to get a free country.
Mm-hmm.
That you could just kind of like walk in and take it over and huzzah, and nobody can do anything about it. And the same reason why people realize that there's nothing in Kickstarter that prevents them from using it as like an early type of VC, like angel fund investment, basically. And I'm fully confident that Oculus will fulfill their Kickstarter orders and will meet all their contractual obligations.
Well, with enough pressure, I hope they do.
Oh no, I'm sure. I'm 100% sure that they will. But that doesn't really fix the problem, right? Because the assumption, in the sense of, even though Kickstarter, there's no contractual obligation for them to stay independent. They didn't do anything contractually or legally wrong, but they found a loophole in the system that allows big companies like Facebook to use Kickstarter as a form of early angel investing and to let good ideas float to the top. And it's zero risk to them. All the seed money has already been provided. And they get a free company that's been funded on the backs of other investors. And there's nothing legally wrong with that. However, it's sneaky.
It is. I think it might not be legally wrong, but it's definitely, there is a level of it being wrong ethically.
I would not disagree with that. And likewise, okay, the parallel to Crimea is different because obviously you can't just walk in and take another country, but sovereign law, like international law, works differently in the fact of like, it's not just what's wrong, it's what you can enforce, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And we found that we can't enforce really sovereign, national sovereignty as well as we thought that we could. But no, I would agree. I think it's sneaky. I think it's shady and it violates, if not the letter of the law, then the spirit of the law, saying that Kickstarter is a platform for you to get money raised for what you can't do. Maybe use it as a term of like short-term funding. So one company that I am super excited about is a company called Adaptiva. They have a product called the Parallella, which is a really awesome little – it's basically a Raspberry Pi with a computing core tacked onto it. And not quite the same because they did a whole bunch of other stuff. They just – a couple months ago, they got a big round of funding from Ericsson and Carmel Ventures.
Mm-hmm.
That was the intent. They used the Kickstarter to fund the initial board designs, the build outs. They're shipping their stuff to their Kickstarters. I'm a Slacker backer, so my board comes at the end of the month. But they've taken and they've infused a bunch more money into it. But they've remained independent. They're still staying in contact with their Kickstarter people. And so in a sense, even though they did similar to what Oculus did, they did it a different way, in which the Kickstarter, and they were very clear that the Kickstarter funding was in an attempt for them to raise more funding for them to do their thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at some point there's a possibility that they'll take a buyout by another company. I could see them getting snapped up by, probably not Google, but maybe like an IBM type of a thing.
I think what bugs me about this is that I've seen a lot of companies in the Bay Area use this model where they just don't fund much R&D.
Yeah.
But they technically kind of outsource it to startups. Like they have a bunch of PhD students or grad students or people who just graduate or even drop out of their undergrad and make a startup. And then they are working on a very specific function and they create their own technology to deliver that function. But then as a big company, R&D is really expensive. You get to burn through lots of materials. You get to burn through lots of salaries for staff. And then you have to like maintain your building. And then you have to the tax is different. So it's a big expense. So what they do is they just buy out these startups and they buy technically their R&D, and that ends up being cheaper a lot of the time than having to foot the bill themselves.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you know, that was kind of looked down upon earlier, but now that it's become the norm.
Yeah.
People that don't quite have such a, you know, a strong reaction to it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's fascinating how much quote-unquote innovation there is in finance and corporate structuring and all this stuff, that there are different ways of doing these types of things. One of the things that I was reading, again, we'll go back to my recent favorite book, in Coca-Cola, they were one of the first, they bought one of the big movie studios, Lionsgate or something like that, back in like the 80s. And they were churning out movies and stuff, and they did a bunch of financial structuring to like move debt around and stuff like that. And it was one of the first times in which corporations had bought other corporations in order to diversify assets, basically as holding companies, and then offloading debt to those kinds of things. That was one of the first times it had been done. Now that's 100% standard, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, there was a big one in the last election where President Obama was talking about that place, address in the Caymans that has like 5,000 companies headquartered at it. You know, and the joke was either nobody's there, either these are a bunch of paper corporations, or that's the world's largest office building.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw a picture of it, actually. It actually is an office building, fairly good size. But yeah, basically, it's just a holding company. They're just shell corporations that go there. I think the less legal term is structured investment vehicles.
Like Roche.
Roche?
Yeah, Roche.
Lab company?
Yes, they bought Genentech. They were trying to buy Illumina for a long time. And they were looking at Life. And they just basically want to engulf as many companies as possible. Yeah. And that's their job as a corporation, is just to like suck up all the other corporations.
Sure. I mean, there are a lot of places that do that. GE's model has been that way. IBM, Oracle. You remember when they were on their buying spree?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mad respect to Larry Ellison to go through a massive, one of the largest buying sprees like in history at that point, and still do a 13% return on assets. Mad props to Larry Ellison there. I mean, that guy knew he knew what he was doing.
How much of that was due to inflation, you think?
Oh, that was far above the inflationary rates. This was early 2000s, so the rates were really low. Because
I popped up Wolfram Alpha, and my dad and I are always debating about whether or not we're inflating or deflating.
Oh, we're absolutely inflating.
Right. Well, that's the thing. I mean, if you look at it from like this big, like 1,000-foot view, it looks like we're deflating. And that's what the Fed was telling us too for a while. But if you pop up Wolfram Alpha and you search, you know, inflation between 2008 and now, you see that, I mean, it reports 15%, 1.5.
From when to now?
From 2008 to now.
See, that's much higher than I'd be interested to see where they're pulling that data. That's much higher than what I've been hearing. I've been hearing in the range of 2-3%.
Which is why it shocked me too, yeah.
I can't remember the last time we were talking about deflation. That's pretty far afield from where we are right now. One thing that I think that we were at, because there's a difference between deflation and a stagnant economy. Generally, those things go together. And then in the 70s, we got this thing called stagflation.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when Greenspan kind of stepped in from not Volcker. I can't remember who took over for Paul Ike or something. And so we had this thing called stagflation. And I think that we thought that we were going to run into it now, and they were really worried about it. But
mm-hmm.
I don't think that we did. They've done a pretty good job of keeping inflation really low. The Fed's been really inflation. The Fed is very inflationary. Like, they're skittish about that kind of stuff. So
right. Well, I've popped open. I just did a quick search on Wolfram Alpha, and on my phone it reported 15%, but it looks like on the website it's reporting 11.23% between 2008 and now, which is still pretty high. It's way above that 2% or 3% that you were.
Well, you're looking at the inflationary rate right here over the last 5 years, and it's hovering right around to less than 4%. So,
but that's the rate at the current moment, not like the overall rate between 2008 and now.
The year over year.
Right. So on the plot here, yeah, you see that it's at 2%, but that's like the acceleration. That's like the rate, the current rate. So if you had $100 in 2008, how much is it worth now? It's
90%, $90 basically.
$89, yeah.
Okay, so for those of you who can't see this because you're not sitting right in front of Nikhil's computer, we're on Wolfram Alpha right now, which is amazing. And Nikhil put in inflation 2008 to now, and you can look at the query there. So, so that's interesting. But our inflationary rate is pretty low. It's pretty good. I think China has a little bit lower, but that's of course. But they're coming under contraction now. Their growth number got revised down for the first time like ever.
Really?
Yeah. So, and then other countries obviously are just like ridiculously high.
So I just searched China. It looks like China's inflation rate in like 1994 was about close to 25%. That's insane.
Well, yeah, that's pretty high. I think in Germany after the war it was in the thousands of percent. So that was just absolutely amazing. But don't look 2008. Look at it back in like 1940 to 1960, and then we'll see what it is.
1930 to now, looking at inflation in Germany. And it looks like they don't have that data. Yeah.
So there it was. Anyways, they used to get paid twice. They would have to get paid twice a day, because the money, if they got paid in the morning, they wouldn't be able to. It'd be valueless by the time they got off work.
Right.
So, anyways, so that's kind of, yeah, that's fun. But Wolfram Alpha is kind of amazing, right?
It is. Beautiful. So have you seen that new language, like that YouTube video of Wolfram's new language?
Yes. You mean the language where it's like, hello, I'm Stephen Wolfram. I'm smarter than you. And here's why. And you just watch it and you go, holy smokes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's mind blowing.
You just like, you realize that there's no way you can contribute to humanity the way this guy has.
Nikhil, give us a rundown on the Wolfram language. How do you interpret it? Because I'm interested to see how you...
Well, it's a language where you basically just speak to it, or like you type something in the way you would like explain it as a human being to somebody mm-hmm. else. And then it kind of has this engine to take that sentence and then turn it into logic and give you exactly what you want. So in terms of like when you basically there's no processing time between asking a question and then getting the answer. Earlier, mm-hmm. you have to ask a question, make your own algorithm, or figure out which algorithm you want to use to answer that question, get your data, you know, parse it, all that stuff, and then answer your question. But now it's just like you ask the question to Wolfram, and it just gives you the answer like that.
Yeah, I think that's a really good description. To me, what it reads is you take a functional programming language like Haskell, I think Haskell's functional, and then F-sharp or something like that, and you fuse it with a knowledge engine. So now when you define a variable, you're not really defining a variable, you quote something or put a string in there, it can process because it understands what those entities are. So one of the examples they used was they wanted to look at all the flags of the nations.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were able to say like nations and flags, and it understood what that phrase was, and it was able to process it. So in a sense, it's taking your query, it's operating as like a functional language, but then the variables or the methods that you're calling, it understands what those are and is able to, process and iterate on top of that. So it's in a sense really, really powerful. I have no idea what I would do with it, but I desperately want to play with it.
Oh my God, dude, there's so much you could do with it. So you know how Google basically just gives you a number of search results for questions that mm-hmm. you, so when you ask Google a question, it gives you a bunch of resources, right? And especially if you're looking for an exact answer, it doesn't always calculate stuff for you. Like, there is a built-in calculator. But if you are asking about, like, something very specific, like, I have a burrito, which is a foot long, and if I throw it across a football field, like, at a force of, you know, I don't know, X,
yeah.
Like, how far will it fly before it hits the ground? And what would be the parabola function? Like, Wolfram will tell you that. Actually, there was one interview I did where we had to program Fibonacci.
Oh, yeah.
And I had to do it iteratively. I had to do it recursively. And then they asked me to speed things up. You know, okay, we've done this, the simple stuff. Let's make it faster. So I used caching on mm-hmm. on the recursion. And they said, okay, let's challenge. Let's make it even faster. I want log one time. You know, big O of one. How can you make it that fast? So I went to Wolfram. And I thought this might be considered cheating, but technically it wasn't, because I'm not a mathematician.
Yeah.
I went to Wolfram, typed in Fibonacci, got the Fibonacci function. Like, they actually have this interesting alternative form, which has to do with square roots.
Yeah.
It's like a fraction. And then I programmed that in, and then I compiled that down to, like, it was written in Python, but then I made it a C function, called it from Python, and it ran an order of magnitude faster.
Wow. That's... Wolfram.
Yeah. Like, Wolfram, I would never have had the, you know, the thought of doing that had I not played with Wolfram and known how useful it actually is.
Yeah.
So.
That's kind of awesome. Yeah, it's a fascinating language and project in which, as they talk about, like, just over the years of building Wolfram Alpha, now extending that into a language. There it is, yeah.
The alternative form right over here. And there's a generating function. There's all sorts of stuff that it just kind of pops out at you.
Yeah, it is really awesome. Wolfram came out about halfway, or I at least started seeing it about halfway through college, and it was like just revolutionized people's homework overnight.
Yeah, I figure if you're gonna have to integrate some, you know, functions here, Wolfram could probably do it for you.
Oh, it can. Yeah, you can do the integral of like x squared from 0 to infinity or something like that, and it works really well.
No, I haven't ever used Mathematica, although
no, we did we used MATLAB when we were in when I was in college, and it pops it.
Yeah, so I just popped in a search for derivative of x squared, and it gave me 2x, which is the right answer. So that's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it's very simple, but you can do some fairly complicated ones. And there was I think I have in the notes for us the Wolfram Alpha one-liners. Which is so one of the things that came out a couple months ago was that Wolfram partnered with the Raspberry Pi Foundation to get like a free copy of like their software or something on it'll just run right on the Raspberry Pi, and that is really cool. And so they had a competition to see like Wolfram Alpha or Mathematica one-liners or something, which is how much can you do in one line of Wolfram Alpha code. And there's some pretty cool stuff. I mean, mostly it's just plotting really pretty pretty pictures and stuff. So
interesting. Well, I see something else over here on our list of
scroll down there. It's a little bit towards the bottom, so I think. Oh, maybe I deleted it. But anyways, it's fairly cool.
Okay. Well, I was going to say that we have something about recollections of Windows XP.
Yes. Windows XP. So for those of you who – yeah, we can probably move on. So for those of you who didn't know here this week, I believe it was this week, Microsoft officially discontinued support and updating and patching for Windows XP. And so Windows XP is something that's near to dear to probably a lot of us for those of us who lived through that whole era. For me, my first computer, which I built in 2000, I think, it was running Windows 98 SE. And it was right after the Athlon XP processors came out. And this thing was a beast. Athlon XP 1600, 256 megabytes of SD RAM. The board that I had could run either DDR or like the just standard SD RAM. And of course, I was so cheap when I was young that I had to run it on SD RAM. I think I had a 80 gig hard drive or something, you know, ATA drive in there. I think this was a monster, right?
Yeah, this was back when we had 400 megahertz as the computer speed, right?
It was a mid-range processor when I bought it, but okay. It was not the top of the XP, but it was right solidly in the middle. So I scrimped and saved, you know, cleaning toilets and mowing the lawns and stuff and built this thing. And Windows 98 SC, right? But I was ready to. It was right before. I can't remember the time period. It was like right before, right after XP came out. Mm-hmm. And so I finally finagled a copy of through a friend of my dad's who was taking classes at the local college, right? And they had the awesome deal where you got Windows XP for $5. And so I got me a copy of an XP Professional. Mm-hmm. And it was everything that I hoped and dreamed that it would be. I know a lot of people complained about I always liked XP from the day that it came out. I liked the way that it looked. I liked the way that it felt. I mean, it wasn't – there was weird stuff and, you know, it wasn't like the most rock-solid stable OS or whatever. Probably mostly because my computer was put together with – it's basically hacked together with, you know, spare parts and stuff, but – That was really the first. I mean, I used Windows 98 on my family's computer, but Windows XP was my machine, and I absolutely loved it.
You know, I recall that Windows XP was pretty much like everyone kind of loved that, but then when Windows 7 came out, and then Windows 8 came out, everyone was just like, "What is happening?"
It was Windows Vista, I think, that did it. And Windows 7 was always. Oh my God! I
forgot all about Vista.
Everybody forgot the Vista. There are two things. Do you remember Windows ME?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Or Morons Edition. That thing was a piece. That thing was like the worst OS ever.
But what was Vista? That came out like for a year or something, right?
Vista came out in 2007.
Its lifespan was just so short.
Because it was so awful. Now, granted, there's lots of, you know, conspiracy theories around Vista or whatever. But in all honesty, Vista changed a lot in the underlying OS and the kernel and everything. And people... There was a difficulty in driver compatibility and all that kind of stuff, which when Windows 7 came out, it was much more tuned, much more stabilized, and then the drivers had caught up. So Windows 7, in a sense, was just rock steady, rock stable, and a lot of people really liked Windows 7. Windows 8 changed a lot of stuff again, And again, most people just complain because, like, I don't like Windows 8. What don't you like about it? I don't like that Metro interface. Okay, well, what about the rest of the OS?
Well, you know what? The thing is, you can't really get to the rest of the OS because you have no idea how to do it.
Hit the start key.
What start key?
The start key.
It doesn't even exist anymore.
It totally does.
It's disappeared. Like, it's just
been
like,
your little start bar?
Yeah.
You're still stuck in Windows 95.
Well, that's the Windows I'm used to. So, you know, I started out in that Windows stuff. And then somewhere along the line in college, I switched to a Mac. And then now Windows is not the creature it used to be. So it's like I can't go back to Windows because Mac just seems like it's more intuitive.
Oh, I definitely prefer OS 10 over Windows, but... I guess I switch back and forth so much that I don't really have a problem.
Especially if we don't have a touchscreen, it seems like it's really hard to play with Windows 8.
You know, it's honestly, it's not. The rest of the desk, again, I've never found it to be super difficult. And I have it, you know, I've got it on the 27-inch, you know, monitor, keyboard, mouse, all that stuff. And it's not the most optimal for that, but... you know, I still do pretty much everything on the desktop anyways, so it's not really a big deal for me.
Speaking of Microsoft, I told you about the Xbox One, right?
Yes.
And I got it all set up. The issue that I had was that my computer monitor, did not have an HDMI input.
Yes.
So I had to actually go out and buy a new monitor. So I went to Amazon, I got a pretty nifty ViewSonic, which had an HDMI input, and it runs my Mac just fine. Like, you know, it's the same resolution and stuff. And it was actually cheaper than the one I got from Korea.
That's right. Now, the one you got from Korea runs, like, at 2,500. It runs at the same resolution of that cinema display that you stole from the department.
I didn't quite steal it. It was gifted to me.
It was. But, yeah, that nice big 30-inch cinema display that jealous about.
Oh, it's so good.
Yeah.
It's a matte display, but you know what? I will take it.
Yeah.
I will definitely take it.
It looks gorgeous. I'm angry at you every time I walk by your desk. So I get that. But yeah, so the ViewSonic is probably 1920 by 1080, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. What's the screen size?
It's 27 inches.
It is. Okay. Yeah. So technically the what do you have? The crossover view?
Actually,
I have the Shamian is the one that I bought from Korea, and it runs at like 2800 or whatever, the high resolution, which I absolutely love. It looks really great. So
I do have the crossover. I'm looking up the ViewSonic that I bought.
Oh, there you go. Yep. The
1920 by 1080.
Yeah.
Yep.
So yeah. So that's and that's perfect for running an Xbox or something like that. Oh, yeah. I like the higher resolution personally for what I'm working, but absolutely. And the thing about those the Korean monitors, one of the reasons they're so cheap is that they don't have a scaler in them. So you have to drive them at the exact resolution.
And the price tag is $250.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great price for a 27-inch monitor. So
That is actually really, really good.
I got that. So basically, I got the monitor. I hooked up the Xbox. I got it to run. And then I had to download... Titanfall.
Yes.
Which is 16 gigabytes and took forever.
I can imagine. Hold on. Can we take a break? I want to hear about your Xbox experience, but can I get you to give some XP recollections before we move on?
Yeah, didn't we already do that?
Were you an XP guy? Did you tell me about? Do you have any cool stories about running XP or anything like that?
Not in general. I remember like the PowerShell. I tried to use that for a bit, but that didn't quite work out.
PowerShell is amazing and also totally ridiculous.
Well, why was it ridiculous?
Because it's not Bash.
How dare you?
It's not Bash. It's amazing. It's .NET in a command line. What you can do, if you figure wrap your mind around PowerShell, it's mind-blowing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a mess because it's not Bash and it's
I do prefer hard Bash. To figure out. Bash is definitely one of my go-to languages.
Yeah.
If I can do it in Bash, I will.
Of course.
But the PowerShell is pretty cool too. Like, especially if you didn't have access to a Linux computer, which in a lot of corporations, they just, for some reason, loathe Linux.
I know. They absolutely do. I can understand that. The management tools for doing a fleet of Linux systems is just now starting to pop up. But especially, and it's definitely for servers, but less for desktops. But PowerShell is a great technology. It's unlike Bash. So, and it is kind of complicated, I think, because everything's kind of object oriented and much more verbose.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can wrap your mind around it, I've written some pretty sick PowerShell scripts that are just mine. I mean, everything you can, it's so extensible, like, and it's built on the .NET, so you can like inspect objects and stuff. It's really kind of cool. But
Well, thinking back to XP, I would play games on my computer, but besides that, I wouldn't do too much coding because I wasn't in that stage anymore. I think a lot of the coding I did was on a Windows 98 computer.
Oh, wow.
And I used to have those zip drives.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I used to, like, actually install games. Like, I remember Rainbow Six. I had them installed on – I had each game installed on a different zip cartridge. So it was like I had a Nintendo, but not –
Dude, hilarious.
Yeah. So that was – I mean, yeah. I think I have more fond memories of Windows 98 than I do of Windows XP.
Yeah. Windows 98, you know, looking back on it, just, like, yeah, again, so many good memories. Remember the – do you have the tiled wallpaper?
Tiled wallpaper.
It seems like everybody that I knew had like the, because remember they give you like those little square, like the little wallpaper squares,
yeah.
And you tile it, right? And so everybody had them. My favorite was the forest, right? So you'd have the forest and then the cool like the little like frame. It's like a picture of like the trees, and then it would just tile across the thing.
Yeah, your desktop would end up looking like the bathroom floor.
Yeah,
but
basically.
I don't know who designed that, but it was interesting at the time.
It definitely was. So, and I remember, do you ever run any alternative shells like GeoShell or anything like that?
No.
I had a lot of friends that did that. I always tried with it, and I just always went back to the regular.
I've never even heard of GeoShell. What is GeoShell?
GeoShell is like, it's basically like a different window manager, but a different shell that wraps on top of XP.
Mm-hmm.
That lets you do a lot more customizing and stuff like that and tweaking and things. And I was really into, when I was younger, I was young and dumb, and I was really into tweaking and modifying and customizing my computer. And invariably, I would just trash it and have to I reinstall the OS like every 6 months or every year or something like that.
Oh,
I mean, it was just a disaster, right? But I learned a lot. I like played around with stuff, and you know, we didn't have high speed internet in my house till the end of high school, so I had an external US robotics modem that I would run the cable down the hall to my parents' room where the phone was, and like all this stuff. And it just, you know, fun things.
Yeah.
So I had a lot of good memories of really digging into the registry and all that different stuff. And so Windows XP, I'm sad to see it go. It was a solid piece of engineering, at least in my opinion. So
end of an era.
End of an era. So okay, Titanfall. I want to hear about this.
Well, it's
Xbox in general.
It's a pretty fun game. Like I you know, pulled out the controller and I just sat down and played for about an hour. I actually got through the entire campaign in 1 hour. I finished the game.
Wow.
I beat the game in 1 hour.
Wow.
But you know, it's not the campaign that's the fun part. It's the online multiplayer.
Yeah.
So that was pretty fun, and I haven't played it for about 2 days now. I mean, it's fun, but it's not addicting, which is a good thing. I also got to watch Game of Thrones on the Xbox. They had
a
free premiere.
That's right. I saw that on Twitter.
And I was definitely, it was convenient to just hit the play button. And I know that as a UW student living on campus, I actually get access to this service called Philo.
Okay.
Which basically gives me HBO Go. I can watch Game of Thrones live on my computer as long as I'm connected to UW Wi-Fi.
That's awesome.
So that's nice too. But, yeah, so far so good. And I think what really sold me on the Xbox, what made me pull the trigger, was the fact that, you know, after you told me the whole keynote that happened, that you can run Windows 8 apps
mm-hmm.
on the Xbox because it uses the same foundation.
Yeah.
So that was like, okay, well, that's not just the Xbox anymore. It's an actual computer now.
Yeah.
So, and at $450 off of Amazon,
pretty awesome.
It was,
yeah.
That was a deal.
Yeah. Now, how is the voice? Do you use like the voice recognition or anything
like
that at all? How is it?
It's pretty cool. I mean, one thing I find annoying is that when I enter my bedroom, the Xbox just turns on by itself. Like, you want to play me? And I'm just like, no, I don't.
Xbox, shut up.
Or turn off. Yeah, Xbox off is what you say.
Yeah. During the keynote at Build, they kept rephrasing. So they had the like the guy up there doing the presentation, and they had the split, basically, it's picture in picture of the presentation monitors, which just hooked up to the Xbox, and he kept saying Xbox, and it kept like ding, ding, like listening. It's like Xbox, stop listening. And so it was keying into everything that he just kind of, you know, a funny little moment. So, well, that's really cool, and I look forward to coming over and playing Xbox with you or something.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even my roommates haven't seen it yet. They're just like dying to, you know, play a round or two with me.
Yeah.
I haven't quite invited them over yet.
You're the cool kid.
I am. I'm the cool kid right now because I got the cool technologies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's really awesome. I'm interested to hear how your perceptions change over time and stuff like that. So,
So I've also adopted your vice of buying $5 books off of Amazon.
Ah, they're a penny plus $3.99 shipping.
Well, yeah.
Or a dollar, I guess.
Which ends up being about $5.
Yeah.
But, you know, I go ahead and pull the trigger now on lots of interesting books.
What have you got coming?
Well,
coming down the pipe?
One is called Zag, which is, I guess if the saying goes, when everybody else zigs, you zag. So that way you can differentiate yourself in the market. You don't have to be better than anybody else, per se. As long as you're different, you're going to have a niche. And that's the idea behind that, I think. There's just a whole bunch of cool outlines and frameworks in that book, which I think I want to reference. So I bought that one. And then I bought the Wall Street Journal Guide to Information Graphics. So there's this lady named Donna Wong, who was a student of Tufte.
Oh, wow.
And she wrote a pretty good guide, apparently.
That's awesome.
Our friend Logan, he suggested this to me, so I went ahead and bought a copy because I figure I'm going to use it quite a lot. And you know, the entire, like, those two books ended up being less than $20,
and they're going to
be really, really helpful to me.
Yeah.
Now, what I've noticed though is on Amazon, when I look for textbooks or anything about like regression or network modeling and stuff, those books end up being like $100.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
And they don't; the prices just don't come down.
No, they don't. It's fascinating. Yeah, anything that could be construed as a textbook is just going to be extremely expensive. So there's a book, a philosophy book that I've been interested in by a philosopher called Charles Taylor, not the Liberian politician.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's at University of Aberdeen or something. It's called A Secular Age, and that book is like $45 or something. Granted, it's a 900-page book, because it's technically classified as like a textbook. It's just unbelievably expensive. And so I'm waiting. I'm hoping. It came out in 2008, so I'm hoping we'll start seeing. Usually you have a little bit of a year or two lag on when books come out and then when they're for a penny on Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, anything that's like – anything that is on like the New York Times list or something that – anything that's like a popular literature, Amazon, less than a dollar, hardcover, in good condition.
You know,
so that's where I get almost all of my – on my books.
Here's something I want to show you. I don't know if you've ever heard of this service. It's actually a website called Camel.
So
camel, like the animal camel.
Yes.
But three of them in a row. And what you do is you basically just type in your item from Amazon, like the URL.
Uh-huh.
You hit go in the search bar, and it tells you the current price, the price that it is at third-party places, and it's priced over time, because the prices fluctuate on Amazon, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you can set up a trigger that says, hey, shoot me an email or a text or a tweet or whatever when the price of this item drops to below
$30
or whatever.
That's really cool, actually.
So you can – like this book over here, The Calculus of Thought, right now it's about $60, and at its low point it's been $57. So you kind of know what the price range is.
Yeah.
And that's for a new book. And if you look for a used one, you can see that it's a bit cheaper and stuff like that.
Yeah,
and you can know when to look at this. So at this point, it looks like in February, it reached its low. And now it's kind of, trending back up to its like $60 price.
Interesting.
So.
Interesting.
It's a cool tool.
Yeah, no, that's quite awesome. So. I've got a couple of books of my own that are coming in. One is a classic international relations text called Arms and Influence, which is a discussion of use of – basically it's written by a nuclear strategist back in the Cold War, and supposed to be one of the seminal texts on use of force and diplomacy and those kinds of things. And then I've got another one that is this is kind of cool. It's The Collected Poems of St. John of the Cross, one of the Christian mystics, translated by this guy named Roy Campbell, who was actually the inspiration for Aragorn in The Lord of the Rings.
Wow.
That is who he wrote that – based that character off of. Roy Campbell is kind of awesome. I think he's an English guy. He's living in Italy – or no, in Spain when the fascists were coming through and sweeping and like arresting people and stuff. And he had St. John of the Cross's like manuscripts, and he hid them in his house and kept them safe and transported them to like – France. And basically he said he made a deal with God that if he survived and made it through this like the occupation, that he would devote his life to translating St. John of the Cross's works
Wow.
into English. And he survived, and had lots of interesting adventures. Like, his wife, like, as they were, like, driving away, his wife, like, they got an accident. His wife, like, died in the car accident or whatever. He just kind of has this crazy story. But so then he collected, he translated the poems and the writings. And supposedly it's supposed to be an absolutely amazing translation. But it's been out of print for years. So I found a hard copy from 1967.
Nice.
That I bought. It cost me like $20, but I was just like, I have to get it. So I grabbed it, and it should come in early next week sometime. So
really cool.
The stuff that you can find on Amazon is just amazing. Just amazing. So I absolutely love it.
It is. And it's just like this rabbit hole. You start looking for books, and all of a sudden your cart is like full of five or six of them.
Yeah.
You're racked up about $100 worth of like stuff you're gonna buy, and you just like tuck it away into your wish list, like, okay, I'm gonna eventually get around to this.
Yeah, that's kind of amazing. So the things, you know, and I still love, there's a couple of really good used bookstores around here and around the university, and so I like to pop in there and just kind of discover, grab things that you never think that you would read before. So,
mm-hmm.
All right, what else is on our list for today? What else are we talking about?
Well, pull the list up. Looks like Medicare, medical ethics, billing information. So you went to a whole talk, day before yesterday.
I did. I went to a talk hosted at Harborview on a... It was called The Ethics of Merging Secular and Religious Hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things is that over the last several years, hospitals have been merging. The regulatory burden is really, really high on a lot of these hospitals. So they're merging. So independent ones are merging into larger institutions. So UW is recently, the University of Washington Medical Center, or UW Medicine, owns 7 hospitals now. And they used to just be like one, and now they've progressively over the last couple decades been buying a bunch more. And so one of the things that unfortunately a lot of the state institutions are not on, they're not shopping for healthcare institutions. So a lot of these small county hospitals are needing to get purchased. And so one of the places that is buying are the Catholic institutions. So mm-hmm. Providence, Franciscan, those kind of places. So now in Washington, they were saying that 45% of hospital beds are owned or affiliated with religious institution, primarily Catholic. And so what's interesting with that is that that Catholic institutions come with a set of governing doctrines called the religious and the ethical and religious directives for Catholic healthcare institutions, which are propagated in the U.S. by the U.S. Conference of Bishops. So they are a translation of religious doctrine into the world of healthcare. And it's, you can go, you can find it online. It's like 17 pages or 20 pages, something like that. And it is largely just kind of like overarching, like, or overarching doctrine or guidelines. It's not specifics like what drugs to administer and things like that, but it deals largely with beginning and end of life kind of directives. And there are constraints that are placed on these hospitals because of their religious affiliation. So Harborview, the Harborview Ethics Committee or something like that, hosted a talk about this on Wednesday. And it was really interesting. One of the things that was interesting was that I would have assumed that if you're going to talk about, one, Catholic social doctrine, Catholic religious doctrine, and two, Catholic healthcare institutions, that you would have a representative from one or both of those organizations. But apparently that's not necessary anymore. So so the panel was a lawyer from policy counsel, a legal counsel from the ACLU, policy advisor from Planned Parenthood, and a volunteer from a place called Compassions and Choice, who was one of the primary organizations that pushed through the Death with Dignity Act here in Washington State. And then it was moderated by a professor in the nursing school. And it was very much, very clear. The talk and the audience came down very much on one side of the issue. But what was fascinating to me was, one, the fact that this was the level of ethical dialogue that is going on, academic dialogue that is going on in UW, that in a sense they were very much, and granted, as a religious person, I come down on one a little bit more on one side than the other. But in a sense, it was very much like, now we're just going to railroad the Catholic institutions. And we're going to purposely, they did say they were purposely to not invite them mm-hmm. in order to keep the discussion focused on the quote-unquote the ethics, which was really kind of fascinating. But it was also just a discussion. It's just interesting to me, if you're trying to discuss, in a sense, religious doctrine in a secular workplace. And it doesn't translate nearly as well as you'd think that it would, because this stuff is built within a religious framework that says this is the way that we view the world. And we view this world through a religious lens that assumes this idea of a God. It assumes all these other like religious concepts and morality, which just doesn't translate well into the secular world. It's not that it has nothing to say, but that you can't just like strip this out and evaluate it as just a piece of you can't take the ERDs and evaluate them as a piece of public policy, because they stand within a larger framework. And in a sense, it's the same with a lot of other philosophical systems. You can't take communitarianism and translate it into the public sphere if you don't have an idea, if you don't believe that there are such things as communities, or you can't take any sort of patriotism without understanding an idea that there are these things called nation states. And so in a sense, you can't take religious doctrine and translate it and say, and without an understanding of that religion has value or has place within the public sphere. And there are lots of things. They brought up interesting points that these constraints that the Catholic institutions put on healthcare are, many of them are valid and need to be discussed and need to be brought up and wrestled with. And you know, for the record, I don't stand on a Catholic position on the death with dignity. So the Catholic doctrine prevents any sort of physician assisted suicide. I think that physician assisted suicide, I don't have a problem to it ontologically, but I think it needs to be held to a very high burden. Mm-hmm. Which I believe that the Washington State's Death with Dignity Act does a pretty good job with it. So I don't match up with them all the way. And I think that they're discussions that we need to have. But in a sense, the discussion on Wednesday was not interested in that dialogue at all.
So what did they actually discuss then?
How it was wrong and how it was unethical.
But it was just very one-sided.
It was. It was just okay. Very much of this is it's unethical for Catholic hospitals to buy secular hospitals, because the ERDs are inherently unethical, which you can have that discussion, but you would think that in an ethics forum, an open forum, that you would have somebody else saying, actually, here's what we're talking about. Actually, here's what this means. And you would have at least a defense. You don't have to be right, but you should at least have a defense. So an example of this is a couple of months ago, I went to a talk at the law school about the right of conscience in pharmacists. Can they not prescribe? Are they allowed to not prescribe certain medications and stuff like that? And Washington State sort of has a ruling on that. Basically, they have to show alternatives, but they can say, I won't prescribe that, but you can go over here and do it. And there's certain limits on that, but they're very much like squishing all of that down. And so now, Washington State there's a suit being brought against Washington State that's saying that they're basically removing right of conscience and how that it's burdensome to religious people and all this kind of stuff. And they brought in the council on both sides of the issue. Mm-hmm. And they did an open talk and they both went back and forth and discussed with each other and stuff. And that was really awesome. You got to hear both sides presented by the people whose job it is to present this. And it was a very... The question and answer was lively, it was engaging, and I was extremely impressed by it. It was sponsored by both the Christian Legal Society and the students, like Students for Choice and Reproductive Rights or something. So sides that are in general come down on both sides of the issue. They came together, they sponsored this, they had some lunch, they had brought in the speakers, and it was excellent. And that's what I'd hoped would be the level of dialogue
mm-hmm.
here, and it was not apparent on Wednesday. And there's a lot of other things that go into trying that went into it that I did some writing on my website, kind of my analysis of it. And so that was kind of disappointing.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, definitely I did not hear about that and I did not go. So mm-hmm. I'm afraid this is going to have to be more of a one-sided conversation.
It's fine. I think I put in the notes, I said rant.
Okay.
And I'm not really ranting about it. I'm honestly not really surprised. And Not surprised that I'm not trying to come down on this as just like they're just trying to persecute all them Christians, like uh-huh. Not talking about that. All I'm saying is that I'm not surprised that the conclusions were reached by the way that the argument was phrased, because there's not an understanding of what Christian doctrine actually says or why they would arrive at such conclusions. And so it's unsurprising that they would look at it and say, oh, this is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
So anyways, but let's move to something else that you can participate in. So okay. as part of my stuff this summer for the practicum that I'll be doing for my MPH, I have to get my immunization records all sorted out. And it's part of that time where I have to get, you know, I have to get my tetanus booster and my Hep B shot or whatever. So I went into the Hall Health yesterday, to the clinic on campus, and met with the nurse practitioner. It's going through getting the sequence done. And I have to do, because I've had chicken pox, so I have to, no, what is it? No, Hep B. So Hep B, the way that you can do it is.
You've had Hep B.
No, sorry. No, I've had my, I'm switching subject. Let me start over. Okay. So I had to get hepatitis B. What you have to do is you have to get a titer to check to see if you have the antibody level. And if you have it, then you're done and you go on. If you haven't had it, if it's a low count, you have to get the shot and then come back a week later and get the titer to make sure that it took.
Yeah.
So the nurse said, here's what you can do. The nurse practitioner said, here's what you can do. We just give you the shot today, and then you come back in a week, and then we'll see, you know, and then we'll verify and you'll be good to go. And that saves you. You may get a shot that you don't need. It won't hurt you, but you may not need the shot. You may not have needed the shot. Or you can do the whole sequence, and maybe you won't need the shot, but maybe you will. I said, okay, that's fine. I want to know, like, what's my insurance going to cover? It's like, I don't know. She said, I mean, that's really the constraint here. It's all just about the wallet. Like, I don't mind getting stuck with a needle. Mm-hmm. But I want to know the price. So I don't know. You have to go talk to Billy. And I'm sitting there, I'm thinking, okay, I'm on the university graduate student health plan. It is standardized. I don't have a custom anything, right? It's the same as like hundreds of other people that come through that every week.
Mm-hmm.
Is there no ability for her to like at least give me like an estimate, a probability of coverage? Is there no way for her to be able to look at it and say, here's what's going to be cheaper for you?
She's probably instructed not to.
I mean, I have no idea why it would be the case. Is it not? She has my insurance information. She has my group number. She has my plan number, my group number. So she should know what my coverage. They should theoretically be able to look it up and say, here's what we'll cover, here's what we won't. And even if it's one of those things like, you know, you get the estimate. Like you do any contract, right? Your auto insurance is one. You get an estimate, and it says in big letters, "This is not a final bill; it may change." Right.
Right.
That's all that I'm looking for. Like, if she can say, "Yeah, well, this is going to cost you $25 ish."
Okay. So here's where I think things get kind of confusing. First off, hospital bills are actually negotiable. If you know that, you can actually call your hospital and be like, "I can't pay your $500, but I can give you $250 in cash today." So you can take that and we'll call it even.
Wow.
Or not. And they'll come back to you and be like, well, we can, you know, do $350. We'll take the $250 in cash and then pay us $100 in a check, you know, within 6 months, and we'll call it square. And then, you know, you're happy, they're happy, and that's actually doable. Like, that's legal. You can call them and talk to them.
Interesting.
And that is all fair game. Now, I had an issue when I first started to work and I graduated college. I got my own health insurance. The hospital that I went to back in the Bay Area, I just went in for a checkup, and they charged my father's insurance for me. And I wasn't covered in my dad anymore because I had my own insurance, right? Or my mom. I kept calling them and telling them to, you know, stop billing my father's insurance and to bill my insurance because I have my own insurance.
Yeah.
The billing department did not do that. They kept saying, okay, we'll take care of it, but they never took care of it. I went down there in person to take care of this. They said that they did it, but they didn't do it. And eventually, this insurance bill that my dad was supposed to pay, his insurance company didn't cover it, so it was billed to my father. My dad was like, there's a mistake. I'm not paying this because it's covered under my son's insurance. Eventually, it went to collections. And his credit got dinged because, you know, the hospital was just too, like, disorganized or lazy or whatever it was to get this all sorted out. So I was, livid that my father's credit was getting dinged because some hospital, couldn't get their own insurance billing organized.
Yeah.
So be careful about that. Like, that is, it's been a bad experience that I've had.
Yeah. It can be really, really messy. And you look at it, you go, isn't this like a perfect informatics solution? Like, query the healthcare database, find their rates, and like, based on group number, plan number, and then put an asterisk by it that says not final.
Mm-hmm. I think another issue with that is that it could end up being sort of a death panel type thing. Because if you have government healthcare and a doctor can look up to see how much they'll get paid for a certain procedure and how much it's going to cost you out of pocket,
yeah,
and how much you can afford, technically if that's the constraint, then that defeats the whole point of government healthcare. Because the idea was to separate the fact that a procedure costs money and that a procedure needs to be done.
There's some of that. Now, we are moving away from fee-for-service into more of a you get paid for the number of patients that you have and something like that,
mm-hmm,
to capitation and or fee-for-outcomes, this outcomes-based reimbursement, which is really cool. So it's not a perfect solution, but shouldn't I be able to get that kind of answer? Or even if it's not, is there another website that I could go to?
You could probably just call your insurance. Call Lifewise.
I could. No, of course. And she said you can go to billing and they'll tell you, right? But I had to make that decision, right? She's looking at me like, what do you want to do? Do you want to do the titer or do you want to do the shot, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, I'll just do the shot. But I had no information to make that decision. And, like, fortunately, it has a zero cost to me. Like,
mm-hmm,
apparently our insurance is less likely to cover titers than they are shots. So there's some of that. But in reality, she was like, I think it costs, like, somewhere around $25. So, like, okay, we're not really talking about, like, real money here. But still, that's just ridiculous.
It is. Definitely frustrating.
So it's something, informatics solution.
I guess in the future you could maybe – call your insurance before you go in just to get an idea.
I could, but I didn't know. I didn't know what I was going to have to do.
Right.
Because I didn't know. I didn't know about the Hep B thing. So.
Anyways. Yeah. And they're making you get the immunizations again. Like you can't just forward them your old.
No, it's what I'm missing.
Oh, got it.
So there's a few things.
It.
So okay. One is there's Tdap, which is a new vaccine, came out in 2005 that the university is mandating. And I didn't get it because I was already done with my immunization sequence.
Whooping cough is covered under that. And that's a thing in
yes, it is.
Washington.
Absolutely. So. Well, I had TD, which is for tetanus and diphtheria, and then I had Dtap or something.
Mm-hmm.
So I already had my pertussis vaccine. But now they want you to do this one. And then I had to prove that I had chickenpox when I was younger, so I had to do a titer to prove that I have the antibodies still.
Mm-hmm.
And then for Hep B, you have to have a TB test. I had to get that done today. And then I had to do Hep B. I needed to get checked for a booster. So I had to get the titer to show that I have immunity for it. And so what we decided to do was just do the shot because there's no harm to you. And then that way, when I do the titer, I'll be guaranteed to be covered. So,
okay.
So I didn't. So all the stuff they went through my records and they got like. So I was caught up on basically everything. I just not the Tdap because they didn't offer it when I was younger, and not and then possibly not Hep B, but we just did safer than sorry. So.
So we're coming up on a minute an hour and 8 minutes now.
Yeah.
So we might want to. Like wrap it up.
Yeah, we can wrap it up. We'll pick this up next. We've got a lot of other cool things to talk about. So
okay. Well, thank you guys for listening. You can contact me at Nikhil Gopal on Twitter, and you can contact Nick at
Nick Robinson,
and you can find us both at Informatonauts. So please be sure to drop us a line. Let us know what you think. And that's all I have. Thank you guys for listening.
Take care.